I'm here to talk to you about what physics is and how physics is done. But I should confess that I've done this a few times with different schools, and I don't have an agenda. What I'd like to do is just sort of start a discussion and see where it goes. There are a couple of things that I could do. Let me just start. Where is everybody from?
Everywhere.
Everywhere. Throw something out. What? Vancouver? Hamilton? Slovakia? Okay, yeah. Outside of Canada? Where?
Croatia?
Singapore?
India?
India? Okay. Anywhere else?
Turkey?
Turkey? Turkey? Okay. I heard that. Anywhere else? South Africa? Wonderful. Okay. US? Yeah, I'm from New York originally.
Spain?
Okay. Is that everything?
Finland.
Wow. Okay. Very good. Okay. No Italians? No Italians. Okay. Okay, great. And I'm going to leave it up to you what I do. I could make this part storytelling, that is how I got, actually when I was at your stage I wasn't interested in physics at all, but how I came to be interested in physics and became a physicist. I could also talk some about things that are going on now in research. My understanding is you've done some special relativity, is that right? So one thing I could do is talk about how special relativity is being tested experimentally and how it might fail, that's where it might break down, giving way to the next theory, if that would be interesting, since, you know, you shouldn't, you just learned special relativity like 3 days ago, right? Some of you, so you should be ready to move on from that. So maybe we'll do that. How many of you all think you want to be a scientist as you go ahead? So almost everybody. Okay, that's good. Does somebody want to explain why? I mean, why would you want to be a scientist? Why? Get to the bottom of things, okay. So get to the bottom of things means explain in terms of the most fundamental understanding that we can have. Okay, are there other reasons? Yeah? Okay, so that's a personal ambition. You'd like the experience of explaining something that nobody else has. Good. It is quite an experience for those rare people who get to have it, yes? Yes. So can I say how I would say that? So the way I would say that is that human culture has different frontiers, and which culture is advancing. There's the artistic frontier, there's the political frontier, the philosophical frontier, and science consists of several frontiers. And we get to contribute to the overall deepening and development of human culture by increasing knowledge about nature. And I also think, which I would add to that, I don't know if it's what you had in mind, that we also have a possibility and maybe even responsibility to keep in touch with the other frontiers so that human culture is not too broken up and disoriented. So, you know, if we have a story about what nature is, what the universe is, within that what human beings are, there should be, that doesn't have to be the same story as comes from arts or humanities or religion or politics, but the stories should talk to each other. They shouldn't be completely alienated from each other. So. Okay, so I went into science for a completely romantic reason, which maybe is related to something that somebody said. But So I was a high school dropout, and I was interested in architecture. And I also knew a fair amount of mathematics, because before dropping out of high school, I had been told that I couldn't learn advanced mathematics leading to calculus. So I had gotten somebody that my family knew to get me into a calculus course. And this was when I was about 14, just at a college, just a university, just to prove that I could do it and that the high school was wrong. Because I was a very rebellious kid. I had bad grades and so forth. So I wanted to be an architect. And has anybody here heard of Buckminster Fuller? Yeah. Yeah, so Buckminster Fuller had come to give, I had invited him to come and give a talk at the high school where I was at. For people who haven't heard of him, he was an American, very visionary architect. And he was one of the very early people to talk about ecology, to talk about the climate of the Earth as an area of interest and problem, to talk about the whole Earth as interconnected, both the human society and the natural part of the biosphere. And he was very influential. And by then, he was a very old man. And he also was an inventor and an architect. And when you say buckyball, so if you've seen these domes made of putting triangles together, he had invented those. And they were quite used. And occasionally, you still see them somewhere. Occasionally, you run into some family of ex-hippies who built one, because it was a common thing to do, at least in North America, back in the 1960s and 1970s. And so since I knew some math, I was interested in the curved surfaces of those buildings, and I was interested in how you could make something that looked like a curved surface, like a sphere, by gluing triangles together. And so I was going to the library, and because I had a lot of time to study since I dropped out, and getting books on advanced calculus and differential geometry, as it's called. And many of the books mentioned that the mathematics that you use to study curved surfaces is the same mathematics that Einstein had used in the general theory of relativity, in which there's this notion that space and time are curved, which I hope you're learning something about. So I thought that was really interesting. And my father had, when I was younger, tried to explain. My father is an engineer, and he tried to explain relativity to me when I was younger. And so I remembered that. And so I went to the library, and I got a book of essays about Einstein called Albert Einstein, Philosopher Scientist, which was in the library. And Einstein was very much both a philosopher and a scientist. And in there was an essay which was kind of his autobiography. And so he explained why he went into science. And so his reasons, which were very romantic, were that human life is very short and ugly, and human concerns are very transient, and they occupy most people, trying to make a living, trying to support a family, trying to get ahead in the world. And that there's nature is all around us at the same time, and nature is constructed from laws which are beautiful, in which if you know some mathematics, you can appreciate the beauty of the mathematical expressions of these laws. And these laws and the beauty that they represent transcends human reality and all the messiness of human life, and it's possible to elevate one's existence, to use a word from you two, to elevate one's existence by spending time with the laws of nature and with the beauty of nature, and kind of escape from the confines of being human or humanity. So that's why Einstein said he went into physics. And at that time, I was 17, and you know, my girlfriend was making a lot of trouble, and didn't know what to do about being an architect, and my rock and roll band had fired me because I was the worst musician in the band. And so I was in a state of angst that appealed to me a lot. And so that's why I went into this. So I decided, I read that one evening and decided that I would do that. And that was basically the framework of the rest of my scientific career. In fact, when he went on, Einstein described what were the two key problems in science as of, and he had written this in about 1950. And for him, the two key problems were the meaning of quantum mechanics, which didn't make any sense to him, and he refused to believe that quantum mechanics was a correct theory, or maybe it was approximately correct, but he refused to believe it really made sense or was the final theory. And the other was the relationship between space and time and gravity from relativity theory and atomic physics and quantum physics. And I said, okay, somehow I got this idea, I could work on those things. You know, if he didn't solve them, I could. And I wasn't an arrogant idea, like I'm going to solve those problems, but oh, here's something I can do with my time. And in fact, I've spent all the time since, I mean, I have not all the time, but most of the time since scientifically working on those two problems, which I can pass along to you from Einstein are still unsolved. So if you want to do something nobody else has done, that would be a place to start. In fact, it's getting like a sort of house guest that stays too long. These open problems have been really around for too long, and somebody should solve them sooner or later. And I have to say, since I told that story, I actually don't believe the premise of it anymore. That is, I don't think human life is ugly, and I don't think that I don't feel any need to transcend humanity or human life. And I also don't believe that the laws of nature represent some inhuman, timeless, transcendent truth. So I no longer have this idea of dichotomy. It's a kind of religious idea between the ugliness of human life and the beauty of the internal truth of the laws of nature. I no longer buy that picture at all. I think it's a very romantic 19th century idea that we've got a lot of reasons in the 20th century to be skeptical of. But I very much believe that laws of nature and the knowledge of physics represents objective knowledge and objective insight into nature. And I think that we're far from done. We're on a journey to increase our knowledge and deepen our understanding of nature, and we're far from done. I think the idea that you sometimes may get from popular accounts or, you know, journalistic or TV documentaries that somehow, you know, we're almost there or we almost have the final theory, I think that's really laughable. As somebody who spent half a lifetime trying to advance that project, I think we know a lot. But, you know, Newton said that he felt when he made his discoveries that he was like a little child playing with the seashells on the side of a vast ocean, and he could play with a few little seashells, while meanwhile the whole vast ocean of knowledge and truth lay mysteriously in front of him. And I think we're still in that situation. Maybe our pile of seashells is a little higher than Newton's pile of seashells, but there's still the entire ocean of mystery right there in front of us. So that's how I got. And then I had some technical problems to deal with, like getting into college to study physics, because I was a high school dropout. But I managed to talk my way into a college where they let me study. And I managed, and this is a very, very important piece of advice, I managed to find a very good mentor who really took charge of my education, which had been largely a self-education at that point, and basically held me in a state of terror for the next 4 years and forced me to learn all the mechanics of doing physics and mathematics, which is not just learning the ideas. The ideas are very beautiful, and if you have a certain kind of agility about ideas, it's very easy to learn them. But being a physicist is much more than understanding the ideas. It's knowing how to work with the ideas, and that's why you do all these problem-solving exercises. Just like musicians spend time practicing their scales, what you're doing when you're doing problem solving is like the musicians practicing the scales. And then, you know, you should, that shouldn't be all you do. If physics education is just problem solving, then it's like you don't ever actually get to play music. The problem solving is just to prepare you and prepare your mind and your skills where you can actually think in a useful way about ideas and about nature. But I was very lucky, and I found a very good teacher. And that's a very important piece of advice there if you want to succeed, which is find a good mentor, somebody who's a teacher, but also somebody who you have a personal relationship with who can guide you through the process of an education. Because you cannot teach yourself physics. You can teach yourself math, apparently. And there may be other things you can teach yourself, but you cannot teach yourself physics, because the skills that you need to not just understand the ideas but work with them, you need somebody to guide you and to teach you through them. At least I don't know anybody who succeeded on their own. And I hear all the time from people who try. Okay. Any comments, questions about that? That's my personal story. You're already way ahead of me because you haven't dropped out of high school so far, probably most of you. And you're also here, which means that you have an opportunity that I never had to be in touch with the real thing. Yeah. I think it's a very relevant question. I think that there's a mythological picture about nature and science which goes something like this. What's really real is not what we experience in time. What's really real are the laws of nature which lie hidden under the phenomenon. And those laws of nature are timeless, they're eternal. That, you know, they weren't born, they don't evolve, they don't die, they're just there. Even if the universe is born, evolves, and maybe even dies, the laws somehow are eternally just always there and are eternally true. And they live in some, if you know the reference, Platonic realm, I mean, the references to the philosopher Plato, who had a view of mathematics, that mathematical truths were not about real triangles in nature, say, triangles or circles, but some ideal abstract triangles and circles that exist timelessly outside of nature. And that's a picture of nature and science that makes the scientist into a kind of priest. That is, we're seeking knowledge outside the world. The deepest knowledge is not embedded in things that happen and that we see happen in our world. It's somehow hidden behind the world. There are historical reasons which are very fascinating to study, having to do with physics being born to a very religious society, and some of the key physicists, particularly Newton, being very religious. I mean, Newton was a very religious Christian of a certain kind, and his, if you know something about him and you read, and by the way, something I really, if you're really, really serious, everybody raised their hand wanting to be a scientist, and many of you physicists, if you're really serious, then get in touch with the history of our subject. Don't take the word of the textbooks for things. Don't learn the subject exclusively from the textbook. Okay? When you're learning Newtonian mechanics, go to the library and get Newton's book out of the library and read it. Read at least the introduction. Okay? So you can find out what in the world was on his mind that he invented these crazy laws. Okay? And what you find is a very religious view of nature and his desire to know God, and he's completely explicit. His view was that space and time are the organs by which God is in touch with nature, and his exploration of the properties of space and time was a religious adventure, or a religious quest for him. And so this is, and it's completely irrelevant what my or your religious views are. It's a historical statement that science and religion were at the beginning very much interlocked. And therefore, this view of what science is arose and is very dominant. So at some point, I just stopped believing that. I mean, I thought that's, it's interesting, but I'm interested in this world. I'm interested in nature. And I don't know any reason to believe that there is some other world apart from the world that we live in. And in my work as a scientist, I'm interested in understanding more deeply the world that I live in and see all around me, and that's all I'm interested in. It's not all I'm interested in, but that's all I'm interested in as a scientist. We see shadows of it. Plato talked about seeing the reality, the people trapped in a cave and not being able to see the entrance, trapped with your back to the entrance of a cave, and just being able to see the shadow of reality on the walls of the cave. That was Plato's metaphor. And that's a very, very strong idea in the history of thought around the development of science, that the real reality is not what we perceive, but is somehow hidden behind it, and that science is a search for that. And that intersects with the truth. I mean, it's true that the fundamental things that things are made of, you know, atoms and elementary particles, are too small to see with our own eyes. Okay. But they're not all hidden. You just need the right instrument, and you can look right at them. You can see atoms if you use the right kind of microscope. So they're not hidden. You just have to use the right kind of device. And one of the great gifts that human beings have and human culture gives us is the ability to invent instruments which greatly expand our range of perception.
Well, if you don't believe in the idea that, according to Plato, you can use your reason to perceive this perfect and timeless world, then what makes you firmly believe that physics is purely an object?
Here's my definition. That's a very good question. Here's my definition of objective. Okay. My definition of objective is that there is a community of people who are seeking knowledge. And they agree to work together within the community according to two principles, which are ethical principles. Okay? One of them is that we make arguments, rational arguments, we believe in rationality, and we make rational arguments from public evidence. That if I argue from an experiment, somebody else could do the experiment and check it. Evidence is always public. There's nothing, no revelation, no private knowledge. Okay. And we agree in good faith to abide by the results of rational argument from the public evidence. So if there's a question to be decided, and the evidence plus rational argument from the evidence decides the question, then we agree to be willing to change our minds. So I have some scientific hypotheses. There are things that I've worked for many years to develop, certain hypotheses. They're experimentally, and I could tell you about some of them. They're experimentally testable. If the experiment goes the other way, and if I'm convinced the experiment was done right, then I agree to change my mind. I also agree that however arrogant I may be, and however confident I may be, and it takes a lot of confidence to work in science because you have to fight for your ideas and represent your work and argue for your work in this public forum or this community. Okay? But no matter how confident I may be, I agree that I'm not the actual judge of the correctness of my work or the correctness. The actual judge is the younger generations 20, 30, 40, 50 years from now. You guys are, whether my work was worth doing or not is actually in the hands of you and your generation. I mean, that's really true. And I'm the arbiter of the work of my teachers and the teachers of my teachers. The second principle is that if there's a scientific question and arguing from the evidence does not lead to a decision, we agree to be open-minded. So we agree, you work on your, you know, you think string theory is right, fine, you work on that. I think that spin foam models are right, I'll work on that. We're tolerant of each other. Just like, and I think that the analogy is not accidental, just like in a democratic society, we agree to be tolerant of people with different views, political, religious, etc., because there's no definite argument that can decide whether one political argument or one religious argument is right. So we agree to be tolerant and to live in a diverse, tolerant society. And we do that because we believe it advances everybody's interests. That is, by agreeing to be diverse and only agree when the evidence forces us to agree, science proceeds on that basis to progress better and faster than any other approach to knowledge. And I think deserves the name of objective, to answer your question. And similarly, I think the historical evidence by far is that democratic societies progress the fastest and create the most good for their citizens because they have the benefit of all the different viewpoints and ideas and cultures, because they allow and they welcome diversity. So that's my philosophy of how science works, which you didn't ask for, but maybe you did. That's my meaning of objective is something is objective if people of good faith, and you have to have good faith, you have to agree to come to a question with an open mind or you're never going to agree. But if you are willing to have good faith and come to a question with an open mind and you agree to be swayed by the evidence, something is objective as if it will sway every person who has good faith and studies the evidence. If it convinces several, it will convince all of them, and then I think it's objective. Now, I've given a sociological definition. I believe that there are things which are really true, which those objective truths capture. Okay. So I believe there is something objectively true in nature about Newton's first law, that if no forces act on something, it proceeds, at least from the point of view of some observers, to move in a straight line with a constant speed. I think there is an objective fact of the matter behind that, okay. But why I believe that is because that's a piece of knowledge which has come very filtered through the process I described, through 400 years of that process. Okay. Any other comments, questions? Sure. I love it. Yeah. Yeah. I don't think being an academic is the only thing to do. So I have lots of friends in the business world and also lots of friends in the arts. So I think that there are a lot of really good things to do in life. I think the important thing is to find out what's the best life that suits you, because I think there are different types of people and different characters. And I think you have a good, happy life if you find a life that suits you. But in my particular case, I like being an academic scientist. I've been extraordinarily fortunate. That is, I have a good situation. I work in a great environment for an institute that has, I think, a good philosophy of how to treat scientists. I love the work, I love what I do. And I should say also, because I start off with this very romantic idea of sort of escaping from human life, one of the things I love about being a scientist is the social aspect of it. You're on a shared journey with other people. You're not a lone wolf out there on your own. You're actually, the life of a scientist is not sitting in a room in a tower all by yourself, not interacting with anybody. It's quite different. Being a scientist is a very, very social thing to do. You spend time alone, and it's important to spend time on your own thinking, working, getting ideas. But almost all of us are parts of networks of friends and collaborators, people of different ages. And the work is very much shared. And if you just walk around the halls at Perimeter, well, this is sort of quiet time. But even now, you see a lot of people interacting. And by the way, a mistake a lot of students make, and very bright students make, is they try to do it all alone. That is, physics, again, you need teachers, and it also helps to have friends. It helps to work out problems with friends, which doesn't mean that you write up one problem set and you all put your name on it and turn it in. But it's really good to look over the homework and try to do the homework. I hope, I'm not saying anything that's going to go to your trial. It's really good to do it with friends, and it's a great way to make friends. Then you go home and you write out your problem set by yourself to make sure you understand it. But you go a lot faster. Look, physics is really challenging. It's not a pure, one of the reasons it's challenging, it's not a pure thing like math or music or something, where there's sort of one side of you which just gets developed to the extreme. To be a good physicist is a combination of different talents and skills. And you need to be kind of well-rounded. And it's actually, it's not easy. Very few people just naturally acquire it. And it's really good to work together with people. And the life of a scientist is very social. So I like that very much. Some of my, not all of my close friends, but some of my closest friends are people that I've worked with.
Yeah. We just gave them advice to only go into the field of theoretical physics if I'm extremely passionate about it, because, well, I'd like to ask you if you agree with this, and if you could share with us, oh, you already touched on this a little bit, but some of the challenges.
Well, let me first ask you, do you agree with that? I mean, how does that make you feel?
I don't know enough about it to take a view on
that. Is this a theoretical physicist as opposed to some other kind of physicist?
Yes.
So you should do experimental physics if you're less passionate? That whoever told you that, they could have meant several things. Okay, let me generalize and then I'll talk some specifics. Okay, so first of all, it's too bad, but it kind of really is true that you have to choose theory versus experiment in physics. Okay, there are very few people. There's a handful. One of them is on our faculty here, Raymond Laflamme, but there's very few people who do both experiment and theory. Okay. And by the time you're done, that is, by the time you're working for a PhD, you're going to specialize a lot more than that. And you can certainly, and you should always be aware of the dangers of over-specializing. But you're going to have to specialize to make progress, to make an impact and on a problem. So you have a lot of choices to make, not just theory or experiment or physics or something else. And whatever you choose, you should be passionate about, because you're going to spend a lot of time with it. And you're going to spend more time than that. And however much you love and however passionate you are about it, you're going to have times when you hate it. Okay. I mean, there's a kind of meme going around that that to get good at something, whether it's science, music, art, whatever, you have to spend 10,000 hours. And that's if you work that out, that's a lot of time. Okay, and so that's the most important thing. The motivation should really be there. There's a lot of good things you can do. And again, you know, I have friends who have a lot of mathematical talent but didn't have the passion and went into the business world or the financial world, and they've done great things. And when they think that what they're doing is too selfish because it's oriented towards making money, they do great acts of philanthropy, or they intervene in the world in all kinds of different ways. So I don't think that academics is a pure, and academics also has a lot of politics, and there's a lot that's dysfunctional. Most universities are organizationally very dysfunctional compared to most companies. So there's a lot to be said for not working in universities. So if you're working in universities, you're doing it because you're doing something that you really love, and you put up with the dysfunction. So I think that's the main thing. Now, somebody might have been saying that theoretical physics is in a strange moment, which is that we're kind of in most of the forefront areas. We're kind of stuck, which is to say that not overall, there's a lot of problems which are good, worth working on, and which are advancing. But in terms of things at the level of the problems I mentioned that Einstein talked about, reconciling relativity theory and quantum mechanics, unifying physics, making sense of quantum mechanics, did a lot of research, but nobody succeeded. And so if you, and it's the most natural thing to want to devote your life to solving those problems, but all the easy ideas have been tried except the right one, which hasn't occurred to anybody. So there's a lot of areas in science where incremental research pays off. That is, you know, there's some drug that works on 70% of the patients, and you can fine tune it and make it work on 80% of the patients or something like that. Okay. And then there's non-incremental research, like discovering a new class of drugs altogether. Okay. And physics also has incremental and non-incremental research. But in the fundamental areas of physics where I work on, we're in need of fundamental breakthroughs. It's not clear that incremental research is worth. Most of us do incremental research because it gives you something to do when you wake up every day, rather than walk around and drink coffee and feel confused. But but probably we should be doing a lot more of walking around and feeling confused. So if you decide I'm going to go into fundamental physics and solve the problems that Einstein couldn't solve, which is the right attitude, okay? But you should understand that it's been frustrating for those of us who've been there. I'll take your question, but let me see if there's somebody else that hasn't raised their hand. Yeah. Anybody else? Okay. Yes. Mm-hmm. Sure. So I think yes in two different ways. One of them is that everybody wants to know what the story is. Everybody wants to know what the universe is, where we come from, what we're doing here, and we have a version of the story. Our version, and our version is incomplete, like, what was before the Big Bang? We have no idea. Okay. There must have been something. It doesn't make any sense that, in my opinion, and this is something that I certainly work on, is what was before the Big Bang. And how you could test ideas about what was before the Big Bang, since that was, there was a lot of heat between, a lot of thermal radiation between us and them that makes it hard to observe signals from before the Big Bang. So everybody wants to know the story, and that's why a lot of people go into science. But a lot of people all over the world want to hear from scientists what the story is, and we have a responsibility, since we're mostly funded by other people's money, we have a responsibility to tell the story as best we can, which means both communicate it clearly and also tell the truth. Because there's a lot of myth-making. There's a lot of simplifying which makes myths. Okay, the Big Bang is one of them. This Big Bang being the first moment of time, which is part of the story that gets told. It's not true. We don't know that it was the first moment of time. We just know that that's where our knowledge broke down. So that's one reason, and I think that that's a very important reason. Another thing is that often people with our skills are useful for a whole variety of things, thinking about climate change, which, by the way, if I was in your generation, I would be thinking really, really seriously of doing nothing but working on climate change, because we're not solving the problem, and you're going to have to live with the consequences. And a lot of what's at issue, if you're trying to, people are trying to construct models not just of the climate, but of how, some things that combine economic modeling and climate modeling to try to figure out what the consequences of different policies and different decisions will be. And that's the same tools, the same mathematical and computational tools that we use. And there's a lot of other things. I mean, I got pulled in because of the economic crisis. So some people from the business world came around and said, you know, the sky, this was 2-and-something years ago, the sky is going to fall in, can you help? And so I got pulled into trying to do some research on the reasons for the economic crisis. And I don't know that I've contributed anything, but I've had the opportunity to learn about a whole new range of things. And I certainly can talk at length about all the incredible irresponsible decisions that were made that made the crisis possible. So those are examples. Yeah?
I think there's a statistic out that says that most people with a PhD in physics don't end up with a researching position. What can we do? What steps could you say that we should take to end up with, to not be one of those ones that end up at a financial institute or something?
Well, So, I don't want to, before saying that, I really mean the thing about finding the other side. I mean, you know, so somebody I knew when he was a graduate student was Nathan Myhrvold, who worked in my field. I was a postdoc and he was a graduate student working in my field of quantum gravity. And then he did very well. He wrote a very good PhD. He got a very good postdoc with Steve Hawking. And then while he was playing around, he kind of had a sort of hobby playing around with software, and he invented a kind of window operating system. And so at some point he felt more passionate about that than about quantum cosmology, and he felt he could make a bigger contribution to that, so he started a company. And 3 years later, the company was bought by Microsoft, and he became the director of research at Microsoft. And now he runs his own company. It was his name, I forget. His name is Nathan Myhrvold. So I don't think that Nathan has, by any stretch of the imagination, had a bad life. Even, I think he's had a great life, and I think he would say that. Even if you discount the fact that he's pretty wealthy. Because I actually don't think that, you know, I think it's good to be comfortable. That it's good to, you know, have a nice middle class level of living. I don't think, my grandparents were poor. I don't think it's nice to be poor. Okay. But I don't see that the people who are vastly wealthy are really happier than the rest of us. Okay. But I do see, you know, it so I'm not saying that Nathan's had a good life because he made a lot of money. I think he's had a good life because he's had creative challenges that he rose to throughout his life. And so I'm just making it clear, okay? Okay, those people who get PhDs, now not all of them have as fortunate careers as Nathan, but a lot of people who get PhDs and then go into something else have wonderful lives. Another one I know who's been at Perimeter to give a talk is Robin Cook, who started playing around with computer graphics during his postdoc. And got interested in that and developed in that direction of computer graphics. And then he became one of the founders of Pixar, where he's vice president for research. And he's invented a lot of the technology that went into making all those movies, in which there's piles of physics. You know, in those animations, the laws of physics are respected. And it's not just because the cartoonists, you know what the laws of physics are. The laws of physics are coded in to the software by which the animators work. And when things happen which violate the laws of physics, it's because somebody, you know, pushed a button on the screen which said, here, you're going to, you know, violate Newton's law. Okay, and he wrote a lot of that software. So again, I think that's been a great application of, and he's had a great life. Now, these people still love fundamental physics and still love research. So having said that, and I could give a bunch of other examples. I think the most important thing is do what you love and find out who you are and what you can best contribute to. And if that, so So it always, there is an overproduction of PhDs, is true. And that can be actually blamed on the funding agencies and because they overpay faculty members to hire graduate students. Okay, so there is an overproduction of PhDs. I have sometimes but rarely seen somebody fail who was really passionate about what they were doing and doing it and doing something good. I mean, some of the failure modes are being too perfectionist to publish. That's a common one. I have several friends whose career did not work in academic science, because if you don't publish, you can't go ahead. You're paid money to do science, and the output is publications. And if you can't figure out a strategy, you may not solve the problem at the core of your passion the first 5 years out from your PhD, but you still should be publishing something towards it. But of the people who were functioning, and that's a kind of not being too perfectionist to publish is a kind of neurosis, and that kind of neurosis will affect people in any domain of life. You have a neurosis that blocks your healthy functioning towards your ambition, then you have a problem that you need to work on, whatever you're going in. But among the people who didn't have those kind of issues, almost everybody not everybody, but almost everybody that was really, really passionate in doing the right thing succeeded. I just say, here's another way to succeed. I know a number of people, not many, because this route that I'm about to describe takes real courage. And there are very few people who've done it successfully. But some people find that their evaluation of what's the most important thing to work on disagrees with the profession so much that they can't get an academic job. But they have a PhD, and they're well-trained, and they are passionate about a direction. And sometimes such people set themselves up just to do research on their own and find another way to make a living. One of them, Julian Barber, did translations, Russian to English, for 30 years, and made a major contribution to our understanding of relativity in space and time without ever working in a university. But got to be very well known, very influential. A very, very rare case, but just it's a possible case. There's some legend about Garrett Lisi, which I think is a little exaggerated, but it is true that Garrett Lisi is doing good theoretical physics, and he makes his money from teaching surfing and sailing in Maui in the summer and teaching skiing in Lake Tahoe in the winter, and which is not a bad life either. And manages every 2 or 3 years to publish a really good paper. It's not a route that I would have had the courage to succeed at. And I don't think it's good for academic science that Garrett is not in a university. I think it's part of the dysfunction of the universities. But nonetheless, if you really have courage and conviction, there are lots of different ways to succeed. And that's, if we learn anything from the 20th century or something, it's the openness of the future. I mean, you control your future. These are not boxes that you fit into. Okay? Everything is you controlling your future. Everything is a negotiation with the structure that exists at every level. This is my view. Okay, we're way past their narrow silo careers. There are lots of different ways to have careers. There are lots of different ways to be an academic. There are lots of ways to earn a living. And the hard thing, that's not the hard thing, is figuring out who you are and what you want to do. And by the way, I'm happy to do this, but I'm also happy to show you a little post special relativity physics. Well, go ahead. We'll take this.
I read this in Rome. I think it was even true that Julian Barber wrote it. The current state of physics is more like a publish or perish sort of thing. And do you think that's like extracting and unnurturing an unhealthy way of getting ideas out there?
So I think that the obligation, if you take a salary to do research, the obligation to report what you're doing is ethical. Now, if people stretch it, somebody may go, you know, what's reasonable is then we can discuss. You know, is a paper a year? If it's a really good paper, or if you're reporting something in progress which is really good, is a paper a year enough? Okay, now we can negotiate, we can discuss it. But I don't think that it's debilitating to have an obligation to write up and publish. I think, in fact, in my experience, it's clarifying because you communication, you know, I mean, let me really emphasize one of, it's not an option in the world of science to be a good communicator. Okay. It's a necessary part of what you're doing, and if you can't communicate clearly what your ideas are, not the day you have them. The day you have them, you're going to be confused the day you have a really good idea. Okay. But if by 6 months from then you can't clearly communicate what that idea was, then it was probably not a real idea. And if you can't then, and one reason the obligation to communicate is good is it disciplines people to work on real ideas. If there's an idea, you know, I have, now I should say, I have had vague ideas, okay, that 10 years later somebody else had in a crisp form, and I went, oh my God, you know, if I had been able to sharpen that up 10 years ago, I would have been ahead of them. Okay, so that certainly happened to me, but that's my fault. Okay, I was unable to have a crisp version of the idea. It was just, you know, feeling something in the dark. And so anyway, that's my sense. So, and as far as publishing, there's two, I mean, now all of physics is on, have you learned about the archive? Yeah, all of physics is there. So whether we should publish in journals besides that is a controversial thing, but posting there so that everybody else in the community of physics can read your work and criticize it. I mean, publishing means putting yourself open for criticism, but if you're not willing to put yourself open to criticism, you're not being a scientist. There are a lot of things you can do where you don't have to put yourself open for criticism. It's like being a performer, and some people, you know, emphasize different sides of it, but, you know, if you want to make a living as a musician, you got to perform. And if you want to make a living as a scientist, you got to be able to communicate what you're doing. Yeah?
How different from your experience is the institution compared to other groups of students?
In the important ways, it's not that different. At the second order, it's really different. So, I mean, it's a place where you get paid to do research, and it works like many, many other places in the world. There, at the second order, there are some very individual things about it which I'm very partial to and which I enjoy very much. I think there's a much healthier attitude towards diverse points of view, towards risk-taking. Yeah, so another way to talk about science is risk-taking. You can take big risk or you can take little risk. If you take little risks, don't complain if after 30 years you haven't made a big breakthrough. Okay. On the other hand, if you take big risks, then don't complain if you fail sometimes. Because the definition of risk is you did something that most of the time is going to fail. And a lot of being a good scientist is judging. Again, this is about figuring out who you are. Okay, what level of risk can you pull off? Because again, it really is about what you pull off in the end. Okay, and a lot of people hedge it by doing little projects and big projects. Okay, one way not to get stuck is if you have a big idea, that's great. Work on your big idea, but also work on some other things that you know you can succeed with. So you're making a contribution to the community that will get recognized, and people will want to have a place for you there. And also work on your big ideas. And be prepared to give up your big ideas. By definition, because they're ambitious and risky, almost all the big ideas you're going to have are going to be wrong. almost all the big ideas that everybody has is going to be wrong. So be conscious when you're taking a risk. But, and so, so those are some of the things. We're younger, which is just the accident of having been founded. That is not me individually, but the average age at Perimeter is young compared to other places, and that's nice. That makes nice atmosphere. There's a pretty open, we're pretty open and friendly, open-minded and friendly, so that's nice too. Okay, so string theory is a big, ambitious idea. The first few steps succeed. That is, you can unify the different forces and the different kinds of elementary particles, so gauge fields, things like electromagnetism and the generalizations, fermions like electrons and quarks and neutrinos, and some small aspects of the gravitational force and gravitational drawing. So all of these things get unified in a very nice way. And a lot of people jumped into it in 1984 when some steps towards proving consistency of the framework were made. There were, by 1986, 87, there were two big issues that emerged. One of them is that to describe nature, so that the theories, if space is just flat, so there's no curved manifold, and space is just like Euclidean space, the relativistic version of Euclidean space, then they have to live in 10-dimensional space-time. Okay. If you want to describe nature, which is three dimensions of space and one of time, there's a hypothesis that the extra dimensions get curled up. And there turn out to be a vast number of ways of doing that. In fact, and by 1986, it was understood that there were probably too many different ways to do that to classify. And I don't know if you know the math. There can be lots of sets in math that you can't classify the different elements of. You can't count them. These are issues of infinity. And it was already pretty clear that all the different ways of folding up the extra dimensions were unclassifiable, which is typically true of problems of higher dimensional, higher than three-dimensional topology and geometry, is that you run into issues of unclassifiability. And each of the different ways, say, topologically of folding up these extra dimensions came with a lot of different parameters because there was different geometric properties. Say the distance around some loop could vary, and there could be 100 different such loops that measured the geometry, or 500 different loops that measured the geometry in a typical thing. So it's already clear 2 years later that there was a vast, what the philosophers call a problem of underdetermination. And the properties of the elementary particles depend on the ways that you curl up these extra dimensions. So how many, whether they're things that look like quarks and electrons and neutrinos, whether they come in different generations, how many generations, what the different forces are, whether there's something that looks like electromagnetism, whether there's something that looks like the weak interaction, that all these things depend. And generic, the generic case looks nothing like nature. The generic case is you know, has lots of particles like the particles in nature, but lots more different types and nothing like the particles in nature. So that's the first issue. The second issue is that the theory is only understood in a very restricted kind of approximation, in which one is dealing with an approximation where the forces are very small, where the deviation from some fixed geometry is very small. And that's the problem that I started working on, because I was interested in that problem anyway, and how to make a theory of quantum gravity that wasn't... All the older theories were limited by just studying quantum gravity effects as very small effects against a background where they didn't exist. And so the short version of the story is that both problems are still there, 20-something years later. And the only thing that's really changed is that there, for a long time, there were hopes that the problems had easy fixes, so they weren't focused on. And starting about 2003, they, especially the first problem, but also more the second problem, became consensus that these are the major problems. And I think that the first little bit that works is interesting and could be part of a future unification, but those two problems are huge problems. Loop quantum gravity is a very different kind of approach. It's much more conservative. It just takes general relativity as given by Einstein, but in a form, in a different mathematical representation written down by Ashtekar. But equivalent to Einstein's form of general relativity, just a kind of deeper mathematical insight into it. And ordinary quantum mechanics and merges them together. And you get a certain distance. Again, you don't go all the way, but you get, there's a remarkable number of steps that you get. And so that, you know, both research programs are alive. I think both research programs deserve to be alive. And both research programs are now in their third decade. Actually, string theory is much older. String theory goes back to the late 1960s, so even more. And the main, I have a sense that in my experience, in my study of history, but especially in my experience, when something works, when somebody has a good idea, it goes fast and it's exhilarating. It's so much fun. It just goes, you know, every week there's a new development. You keep thinking of things. Your friends keep thinking of things. It just goes boom, 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 boom. And then it runs out. Okay. And then you wait for the next thing like that. And I think that in quantum gravity, the ideas of the 80s, which both of them are ideas of the 80s, were good ideas, but they're not, neither of them goes all the way through. There are things that I could say, there's a kind of philosophical viewpoint behind loop quantum gravity, which I think is more closer to the right idea. That is, taking the theory really, not studying small effects and taking an approximation where you just study small effects, but grabbing the whole tiger, I think is as a method, is a better method. It's barely okay. I'm trying to figure out the best way to say it. It's barely okay that when I like walk on the University of Waterloo and I hear people playing music, you know, out their dorm windows, that about half the music was music that I heard when I was in college. That's like barely acceptable, okay, with my notion of progress. And it's definitely unacceptable that people in graduate school now are working on the same problems that my teachers worked on when they were in graduate school. Okay, I'm very impatient. I think that the scientists are way too conservative as a body, and we tend to keep ideas. I think it would be much better to kill ideas prematurely and deal with the few cases of consequences of killing something prematurely than keeping something around for too long. And I think that both of those are theories which we've learned something about, but purely they've been around too long. Yeah.
What do you mean it's not a safe approach? Well, here's what I hope I said, so let me say it again. Let me say it slightly differently, okay? I think there are different aspects. We live in different worlds, okay? We live in a natural world, and the best method for getting insight into the natural world is science, okay? We live in a social world, and I think the best way for progressing the social world, broadly speaking, is politics. Because the social world is something we should be active in. Okay? We live in an imaginative world, and I think the best way of living in the imaginative world and enhancing our living in the imaginative world is through the arts. No. No. And I think that part, a big problem that we face in culture is the siloing, the extent to which is not completely true, to which people in these different worlds are ignorant of each other. And this used to be, my sense is that this is, it's actually getting better, especially between science and the arts. So there used to be, there was a famous book by a writer called C.P. Snow, who was a British novelist who was also a biologist, so he spanned those two worlds. And he wrote something which he called the two cultures problem, that the people trained in the arts and literature and the humanities have no conception of the simplest things in science. They can't explain the laws of thermodynamics or, you know, or how natural selection according to Darwin works. And then the people in science also are pretty ignorant about the arts. Now actually, my impression is that there is a lot of ignorance, and the ignorance is mutual. That is, most scientists could not tell you what contemporary painters or filmmakers really talk about. That's when they get together, you know, they have a notion, you may not know it, but I don't know if, how many of you are painters. Okay, so there's a notion of progress. There's, throughout the centuries, there's a notion of development and progress in painting. And when painters get together, they talk about their issues, they talk about which are issues affecting progress, and they talk about research. Painters do research, and they make progress, in their view. Okay? And very few scientists could even name an issue that all the artists are thinking about, that they think is crucial to the to the future of art. Yeah? Special relativity. Sure. So let me just finish my sentence, and then I'll do that. So I think that that's a problem, and I think that there should be conversations between people who are at the forefronts of the different areas of culture. So that's what I said. Yeah, and then I'll get to her question. I don't think that say, politics or art is encompassed by mathematics. No. So, no, I don't think just by mathematics you can get to these other domains. No.
So you
don't think that could there be a final theory of nature? We're far from it, but I'm not against the idea. Like, I'm in favor of, you know, I'm against poverty and illness, too, so I'm also in favor of a final theory. Okay, but I don't see it on the horizon. But if it was, so I don't think that all the knowledge that worth knowing is going to be derivable from mathematical equations. No. No. Okay. So let me address this question. And so we get to do a little physics. Okay. So one of the principles of special relativity is that the speed of light is a constant. Right? So you've discussed this. So C is a constant. Okay. So that's a principle that can be tested, and has been very tested. So let me make a hypothesis, because to test an idea, to test a theory or an idea, often you have to have an alternative hypothesis. Okay. So let me make an alternative hypothesis. My alternative hypothesis is that the speed of light depends on energy. So let me say that the speed of a photon, the photons are often written with the Greek letter gamma, okay, is the speed of light times 1 plus a constant I'll call A times the energy of the photon over a certain energy, which is called the Planck energy, okay, which is a fundamental quantity that comes into quantum gravity, and I'll define it in a minute. And there could be other higher order terms. This is to linear order in the energy. There could be terms of energy squared, energy cubed, and so forth. And the Planck energy, so I know the Planck mass. The Planck mass is square root of Planck's constant over Newton's constant times the speed of light to the fifth power. So if I multiply by c squared, that under the speed of light, that just makes it like that. I think that's right. Somebody can check. Some power of the speed of light, which is an energy. Okay. So this is an energy where which I could write down using all the constants that come into physics. Newton's constant for gravity, the speed of light for relativity, and Planck's constant for quantum mechanics. And this energy is what, do you guys know what a GeV is? A GeV is roughly the energy of a proton. So this is 10 to the 19 GeV. If you want a more precise number, it's 1.2 10 to the 19 GeV. So that's many orders of magnitude higher than the energy in the collisions at the LHC. Okay? So supposing I'm looking at a gamma ray, and supposing I'm looking at a gamma ray of something like 10 GeV, okay, then this is a number of 10 to the minus 18. Okay, so that's a really small correction. Okay. But if you think that quantum gravity alters fundamental physics, one way to think about it very simple-mindedly is just to use dimensional analysis and just say, where could effects come in? So you just want to find effects proportional to some energy over the Planck energy. This is called being a phenomenologist. You don't have a deep theory. You just say, where could there be trouble? You have a new constant in nature, which is this. When the energies get to be of this size, you expect new things to happen. Therefore, you expect new effects if you have some particle of some energy in ratio of that energy to this new energy, which denotes that this is like the Planck energy is the new frontier where we see the new unified physics. So we see the first inklings of it in everywhere, but with a size given by this amount. Okay, this is the way that we think. We think very, before we think about deep theories, we think very loosely, and a tool for thinking very loosely is dimensional analysis. Just throw some equations on the board, figure out what your fundamental constants are, and use simple ideas like there should be quantum gravity effects when the energy is large compared to the Planck scale, and they should go away when the energy is small compared to the Planck scale, because the Planck scale is where you expect new physics, so you expect, you know, if I had a photon of the Planck scale, really new effects. So I want to just take all my equations and put randomly terms in them of order the energy over the Planck energy and just see what happens. Okay? And this is the kind of creative thinking that many of us do. And so one thing, and I could tell you a story of how extending and deepening the principles of special relativity could lead to something like this, but I'm just going to throw it on the blackboard. Okay. Okay. And A is some constant. It's a unitless, dimensionless constant. We don't know what it is. We'd expect it to be, you know, a rule of thumb in physics is that you use dimensional analysis and the constants that you have to set the order of magnitude of some effect. And then all the other constants, which are just numbers, should be things like 1 half, 1 over square root of pi, things roughly of order 1, not too big and not too small. Okay. So this is a thing that you might expect to see. Okay. Now, 10 to the minus 18 is a really small number. Okay, so does anybody have any idea how this might be seen? With current technology? No chance in an accelerator. Not that I never heard an idea anyway in an accelerator. Let's write another formula. Supposing that I have some source of photons, and I have two photons, a gamma, a really big one, and they start off and they travel, and I have a detector here. I'm a very bad drawer of these things. And I have a detector. And let's say that A is positive. Let me say that A is negative. It'll raise less questions. So it means the big photon, by big I mean it has more energy. The big photon should arrive after the lighter photon. Okay, so I want to know what's the difference in time between the arrival of the bigger photon and the lighter photon. Okay, so the difference in time is the distance it travels, L, times what? Yeah, it's over the difference in velocity, right? It's over the distance in velocity, I have to do dimensional analysis. And the difference in velocity is basically the same formula. So let me write the formula. The difference in velocity is delta E over E Planck. And I'm about to get into trouble here. No, because I'm interested in the case where... Yes, you're right. Thank you. Who is that? Right. So L over V2 minus L over V1. So tell me more. Right. So that's L over V times delta V. With a factor of 2, in fact, because V2 is V1 plus delta V. So then it's L, V is like V1. Okay? Thank you. You saved my life. Okay. Is everybody with me? So this is finally delta t, the speed is about the speed of light. So it's like 2 L over the speed of light times delta V, which is delta E over E Planck. OK, good. So we have a formula. OK, we want to get this number here is 10 to the minus 18. This number here is 1 over C. Okay, so in centimeters per second squared, this is like 10 to the 10, 1 over 10 to the 10. I'm just doing orders of magnitude, right? Okay, so this is, for 10 GeV photons, which are really big, heavy photons, that's a photon 10 times more energetic than a proton, than the whole mass of a proton, okay? So this is... L in centimeters times 10 to the minus 28 seconds. Did I do that right? Yeah, OK. So where am I going to get a factor of 10 to the 28 in centimeters? I mean, if you'd like to get delta t, you know, up to some reasonable fraction of a second, because I'm telling you that this is real, and I hope I did the math right. I easily could do, this is why it's good to have friends. I easily could have done the math wrong, but I think it looks right. Okay. So supposing that the photon had been traveling for 10 billion years. Okay, does anybody know how many centimeters that is? Light years. Okay, it's about 10 to the 28 centimeters, if you work it out. Okay, 10 to the 10 light years, is, so 10 to the 10 years. In a year, there's 3 times 10 to the 7 seconds, and the speed of light is 3 times 10 to the 10 centimeters per second. Okay, which gives 10 to the 28? So something traveling for roughly the age of the universe would do it. I'm glad it worked out. I have a lot of self-doubt about my arithmetic, but okay, are you with me? So all we need is an experiment where we could see a 10 GeV photon and a less energetic photon coming from something from 10 billion light years away. That's all we need. Does anybody know? Does anybody know of such sources? Okay. So it happens that there are such sources, and they're actually not rare. They're called gamma ray bursts. And gamma ray bursts are very brief, very intense bursts of light that seem to be at cosmological distances, as they seem to come from all directions in the universe, and they seem to come from very far away. They, roughly speaking, in a time scale of 1/100 of a second to a minute, they pack an amount of energy proportional to the brightness of an entire galaxy within that. So for that brief span of time, they have the energy output equal roughly to the whole galaxy that they're in. So they're very bright. What are they? We're not sure. One thing that they might be is two black holes that have spun around and are coalescing, giving rise to this huge burst of light. Or they might be a black hole in a neutron star or two neutron stars. Okay. And they happen, does anybody know how often they happen? Okay. So they're observed. So to see gamma rays well, you have to get out of the atmosphere. So they're observed by satellites, and they're about once a day. So there's actually a lot of data. Does anybody know how they were first seen? They were a spin-off of the arms race. They were first seen by satellites that were put in orbit to detect nuclear explosions. And the satellites saw every few days gamma rays, which were believed to be coming from nuclear explosions, which was a big political problem. And then it was realized that they were coming from up and not down. Okay. Now, about once every so recently, a satellite was put up called Fermi, named after Enrico Fermi. Fermi has been in operation since last spring. And since last spring, has seen about 9 events with photons in the range of GeV to 15-20 GeV. Okay. So this is real. Okay. Now, what's the obvious question? Yeah. Well, so yeah, let me be precise. Okay. When I say this is real, okay, the chance of observing this effect is very real. Okay. I'm not claiming that the effect has been observed. Okay, let me be very clear. I'm not claiming that the effect has been observed. But the possibility that is that we have an instrument. I talked earlier about having an instrument, you know, using instruments to increase our resolution, our gaze. So basically, what we're doing here is we have a three-part instrument. We have a gamma ray burst, which is working for us, going bam, sending all the photons out. We have the entire universe, which is serving as an amplifier. That is, the effect is proportional to the distance traveled. So let's get some photons that have traveled the whole, you know, history of the universe, 10 billion light years. Okay. And then we have the Fermi satellite, which is up there. And what the Fermi satellite sees, of course, life is not that easy. What the Fermi satellite sees is, so let's say this is time going this way, and this is energy going this way. The Fermi satellite sees is a bunch of stuff, a photon, a photon, a photon, a photon, a photon, like that. Okay? And at the moment, they are studying the data, and they're trying to see if they can pull out a measurement of this effect. So this is something that may happen not just in my lifetime, in your lifetime, but may happen like before Christmas. I mean, it would be a nice Christmas present, actually. For example, there was a wonderful burst a year ago, which was the most energetic event ever seen by any observation in nature. And that has a bunch of low-energy photons. And then it has, 16 seconds later, a photon with 13.6 GeV of energy sitting up there. And if you plug, and it has a redshift. That is, they were able, after they observed the burst, other astronomers were able to see it optically and see the galaxy, resolve the galaxy where this happened. And it has a redshift of 4.3, if I remember, which works out to a distance of roughly 10 billion light years. And if you put in the numbers, okay, 13 GeV and 16 seconds. So there's this constant A here, which is what you're measuring. And A comes out to be something like a tenth. Okay, so if you put the numbers in, it's pretty good. Okay. Then 5 seconds later, there's a photon at 7 GeV. So it's not clear. Of course, nobody says that all the photons left at the same time. If all the photons left at the same time, we'd be done. Okay. But this is a huge, you know, cloud of plasma streaming, you know, expanding in an explosion. The wave front or the shock front of this plasma is going itself at the speed of light. I mean, we don't see it. All we see is the photons that come off. Okay. So the situation is not clear, and it's not clear that all the photons come off at the same time. Maybe this photon came off later, and this photon came off still later, and there's no effect. Yes? There are two ways. One is to make a model that you would believe for other reasons of the burst, which is unlikely, which is very unlikely. There are three ways. Okay. Another is to do statistics. That is to average, to capture many, many, many bursts and average and see if there's a trend where this formula holds on the average. Okay. Another is to capture a photon. So whatever is going on at the star or at the gamma ray burst, it's something that's taking on the order of seconds itself. And that you can understand just from relativity and the size of the thing. Okay. So supposing that you had a 1,000 GeV photon, okay, which would come not 10 seconds later, but 1,000 seconds later. then you would be pretty sure that that wasn't a very energetic photon leaving 1,000 seconds late. Okay, so you tell the people who have, so 1,000 GeV is a TeV, and you might be familiar with a TeV because several TeV is the scale of the energy in the LHC. Okay, so you might say, does anybody have detectors to see photons, which energy of TeV? And the answer is yes. So you say, great, let's write to them, let's get them to make sure that they turn on their detectors, and let's get them to coordinate so that when the gamma ray detectors, gamma ray burst detectors see a thing, they send an email right away saying, how long is 1,000 seconds, somebody? Order of magnitude? Just to make sure we're all on board here. Yeah, so you have 15 minutes to turn on your TeV photon detector. See if you, you know, and you may have to steer it. You may have to go and steer the thing and point it to where this thing is, okay? So there are such things underway. So that's the good news, is that there are attempts to coordinate and see. There is a bad piece of news. Bad piece of news is that space is not empty. And a TeV photon, and space is full of photons. And it's full of two kinds of photons. It's full of the cosmic microwave background photons, and it's full of photons in the infrared, mostly coming from starlight and dust cooling down and stuff like that. So there's a lot of infrared photons around. And it turns out that a TeV scale photon, if it meets an infrared photon, will interact with it. Now, that's very peculiar, you might say, because there's no actual, light doesn't actually scatter from light. Light doesn't interact with light. But in quantum physics, it can, because they can make a little virtual pair of electrons and positrons and interact through that. You're going to tell them about that, right? Yeah, and interact through the little virtual pair of electrons and positrons. So at extreme energies, photons do interact with each other. And so a lot of astronomers believe that they can't see 10 TeV photons coming from very far because it would be absorbed by scattering off of, just like light in the atmosphere, red light is scattered, and that's why the sky is blue. 10 TeV light would be scattered by actually the starlight. Okay. So there's and this is the way science goes. Okay. Then somebody else says, whoa, wait a minute. Okay. You used relativity in that calculation of the scattering of light by light, okay? And we're trying to test relativity here. So if relativity is wrong, then maybe your formula that gets light to scatter from light is wrong, okay? And so there's a bunch of controversy. People writing papers say, no, you should still see the 10 TeV photons, because if relativity has a correction to it, okay, then actually you have to redo those calculations, and they turn out to change remarkably, depending on some other things. Okay, so the situation is very unclear, but I'm trying to answer this question. Certainly, if you saw the 10 TeV photon to come in 1,000 seconds later, that would be 10,000 seconds later, actually, the 10 TeV photon, okay, which is weeks. Okay, so if you could get your 10 TeV photon detector to stare up, and at the right time, several weeks later, it got a photon, then that would be pretty convincing. Yeah. Or let me, well, look, two questions, three questions, and then I'll, yeah.
So if you do the calculation of the correction based on that correction that you're testing for, that's not working.
Well, there's a problem, okay, which is, so this is the way that physics really is, it multiplies. There is the same effect for cosmic ray protons passing through the cosmic microwave background, which is that an energetic enough cosmic ray, okay, will scatter off of the cosmic microwave background and lose energy. Okay. And that energy is required is much larger. That energy is required to do that is 10 to the 19 electron volts, which is about 10 to the 7 TeV, something like that. Did I do that right? Yeah. So at 10 to the 7 TeV, a cosmic ray proton will scatter from the microwave background, and we know the microwave background is there. We have really good observations of the cosmic microwave background. And that's a prediction of the same mathematics that involves relativity theory in the same way. And that, in the last year, has been confirmed. That's been confirmed by a detector called Auger, which is in Argentina, and which is actually a sort of 100 kilometer by 100 kilometer array of cosmic ray detectors. And they have seen convincing evidence that there's that you don't see cosmic ray protons above this energy, okay, unless they come from some so close that that this effect would not have had time to happen. So there's a pretty good confirmation of that. All this is happening, you know, sort of this year right now. But so the response back to the people about, whoa, you know, maybe that stuff is wrong is it looks bad in that other example. Okay. So the situation is messy. Okay, last couple of questions. Yeah? That's a very good question. And in the case, and how they know that they see them coming from nearby is they look where in the sky they come from, and they compare that to catalog of galaxies. And the result, which is a result of this observatory, is that every time, almost every time they see a proton above this energy, it points to a galaxy which is known to have a big black hole in the center. Yeah?
I have a question that is not related to what we're talking about.
Okay, so I'm going to make that the last question. Is there any last question about this? Okay, last question.
You mentioned earlier that if you were in our generation, you'd be really interested in global warming and environmental sciences.
Well, climate change, yeah. It's a very different kind of science, but there's a lot of theory and a lot of modeling that goes in both to the models of climate change itself, and equally important to the economic models of what to do about it. So when somebody says, you know, if you Obama proposes some set of steps, you know, cut this down by 80% by 2025, et cetera, okay? And then somebody in England, the chief economist of England, publishes a report and says the effect of doing those steps is that GNP will be 3% less 50 years from now, okay? And if that's right, and I'm editorializing, if that's right, okay, to avoid worldwide catastrophe so that in 50 years from now you can be 3% less rich is okay. I think we'd all vote to be 3% less rich in 50 years if that avoids catastrophe. Okay. But how do we know how reliable are the economic models that the chief economist of England used in that case? So there's a lot of work which is mathematical and computational, both in economic model and in climate modeling. And I mean, it doesn't have the fundamental appeal of discovering the laws of nature, but it's the same kind of day-by-day problem-solving skills. And it's clearly a huge public good. So that's behind my saying that. Okay.
If you were our age now, would you have changed your mind and gone into climate change instead of physics, or would you have thought about that?
I would. I think about it now. I just tell you, so it's very hard for me to extrapolate, I can try to invent an answer, but it would be clearly an artificially invented answer. So I'll tell you something which is true, which is that when I meet people in the climate science world and climate modeling world and economics world, I ask them, do you need help? And are there things that somebody with the skills of a physicist could do? Or is the field saturated? Are there enough people working on it? And they say, no, we need help. There's a lot to do. And I do spend a little time more recently on the economic side than on the climate side. Now I haven't completely switched my activity to that, but I have put my foot in the water, I've put my foot in the door. Okay, thank you very much.